There are a lot of very fine first-rate minds in here. But by my experience in this building, none of you have ever been taught the tools by which your mind can work easier on the information you get from the outside world. We concentrate on ideas and the structure of how people think. So memorizing things and writing it down on a test never happens in here at all. It doesn't happen once. You may have tests, but they won't have anything to do with paper and pencil. And you begin to understand how to use these tools, you will have taken a giant step forward to being a powerful, independent human being.
Hey everybody, this is Brett and welcome to School Sucks Live. Tonight, I'm going to start out in the studio alone, but on the phone with me is Mr. Stefan Molyneux. Steph, how are you doing tonight?
I'm great, Brett. How are you doing? Happy New Year, brother.
Happy New Year. Glad to have you back. It's been, well, you were on with us at Porkfest briefly, but before that, it was sometime in 2010 that we got together to do a show. So a lot has happened. You've had a lot more time to be a dad. Your daughter's growing up. She's four?
Yeah, she just turned four.
Education has begun.
Oh, boy. Education began at the very beginning. I remember when she was fairly close to newborn, a couple of months old. I used to lie her on her back and grab her feet, sort of put them up to her bum, and then she could push herself forward along the ground. And I think that's one of the reasons why she walked so early, is she really enjoyed having that kind of control, being able to push herself. I remember going up and down the hallway a whole bunch of times. And so, yeah, the education has begun. And I think, as most parents will attest, it's a completely mutual education. I'm certainly receiving as much, if not more, out of it as I'm putting in. So it's a real privilege and a pleasure.
I've seen some discussions between you and Dana Martin. Has she sold you on the idea of unschooling? Because I remember you being a little bit skeptical.
She certainly sold me on the idea of unschooling, in that it's kind of in the mix of things to consider, which I wouldn't really say that it was before. Homeschooling was kind of radical enough for me, but unschooling is really pushing the envelope. And her idea of sort of stuff happens and you just kind of let kids learn and make their own mistakes, it's so counter to not just my upbringing, but what I understood as upbringing growing up. So I'm still trying to square that circle in my head, but she's definitely making great progress at dissolving the toilet trained at gunpoint fascist chains that unfortunately was my heritage. So I guess she's appealing more to the Irish side of me than the German side.
And you spent some time in boarding school, correct?
I did. I spent a couple of years from six onwards in boarding school, also known as a breeding ground for the Orwellian style colonial dictators that they needed to run a fairly brutal empire. You know, separation from the young, fear of authority, exposing you to lots of very harsh peer pressure and canings and all of that kind of stuff. It's good at stripping out any remnants of empathy that you don't want bleeding in to the consciences of the upper class. So, very effective, and I'm very glad it wasn't longer than it was.
Well, yeah, I wanted to ask you, something that I run into a lot with the people that I interact with here in New Hampshire, people say is, well, you know, I always understood this stuff. I always understood that the school system was corrupt. The school system was, this attempt to get me to be obedient and to conform and to control my behavior. And, you know, I always knew the state was bullshit. And I'm really surprised to hear these things, because I was deeply confused about a lot of these issues for a long time. And I remember internalizing a lot of that school experience and childhood experience, probably, you know, I think for some people, this can continue right into adolescence as, boy, I hope I can figure out what's wrong with me, you know, because I'm not fitting into this this mold.
I was certainly a fine, good little status Christian when I was younger. I mean, I was brought up in the church. I was in the school choir, and we went to church several times a week. And whenever I'd go and stay with relatives, they would always, we'd go to church and so on. And I didn't have any sense at all that the world should be different than the way it was. I mean, there was lots about it I didn't like, but you know what? I didn't like going bald or being subject to gravity, but I just don't think these things are kind of optional. There was a lot I didn't like about the world, but I really didn't have any sense whatsoever, Brad, that that could be fundamentally different than the way it was. I mean, that took Ayn Rand and a bunch of other thinkers, but mostly Ayn Rand, to sort of explore that possibility within me. So I rejected, but I kind of rejected it like I sort of sent my soul on a Samizdat mission, sort of sent it underground and said, well, there's lots about this I don't really like, but I get it, but I better keep it to myself, because it's kind of not liking that it rains. You know, this is just the inevitabilities of living on the planet Earth. And so the fact that I didn't like it didn't really give me any sense that it could or should be different. So I certainly can't claim to have had any innate understanding. I mean, I remember as a kid just going, like, we moved to Canada in 1977, and you could buy a candy bar for a dime. And I remember the price going up like crazy, and it sort of stabilized around sort of 80, 90 cents a dollar within a decade or so, decade and a bit. I do remember thinking, well, that's kind of freaky. Like, why are the prices going up? And so I sort of imagined, okay, well, I guess maybe the wages are going up. Like, I couldn't, and it's because I, of course, knew no exposure to monetary policy, fiat currency, the central banking or anything like that. So I do remember being kind of confused by some stuff. And I also remember as a little kid, I was asking my mom, and I said, I can't remember how old I was. Maybe, I think this was while I was in boarding school. I was home for some Christmas, and I was 6 or 7 years old. And I remember saying, Mom, how long did the First World War last? And she said, 4 years. And I said, who started it? And she said, Germany. And I said, well, how long did the Second World War last? And she said, 4 or 5 years. And I said, well, who started it? And she said, Germany. I remember thinking, okay, that can't just be a coincidence. There has to be, there was some rational explanation for these repetitive patterns. I remember thinking about that stuff, but I had no clue whatsoever about any of the sort of alternate stuff. I mean, this is pre-internet. This is back in the golden days of 2.5 television channels in England, a grainy black and white TV seemingly devoted to endless reruns of Bond movies and sweaty-faced contestants in a puzzle game. So I think a lot of people did maybe feel that there was some alternate that could be achieved. I knew it wasn't that much fun to be in the world the way that it was, but I no more imagine changing it than I would changing the laws of physics.
Yeah, the clearest thought that I remember from growing up was, gosh, it's too bad that this is the way that it has to be. And I'm not talking about the larger world around me, which I was pretty much oblivious to that at that point. But then, you know, growing up and learning a little bit about history, before I was introduced to any of these ideas that we discuss so regularly today, saying, is the world run by the dumbest, most myopic people out there? Or is there just some other agenda that they're not sharing with us? So I think that's similar to your World War One versus World War Two, and really, you know, being the same war with a 20-year break in there idea. But just feeling like, gosh, it must be something that I just can't get my head around. And if I can't understand why this makes sense when everybody else is walking around, at least acting like everything that's going on, from the school to the political to the cultural, makes sense.
Mm.
So you're aware of it. I just remember saying, gosh, it's too bad it has to be this way.
Yeah. When I was growing up, there were two groups of people who were responsible for all the ills in the world. And those two groups of people are why authority had to be so harsh. Now, the first group of people were foreigners. And obviously, the Germans were pretty high up on that list. And the most enthusiastic of the Nazi supporters, the French, and the Italians, who apparently couldn't fight their way out of a calzone bag. So there was the foreigners who caused lots of problems. You know, we were just sitting here innocently enjoying our tasty white man's burden, raise up the brown-skinned people to the elevated ranks of Christianity empire. And then out of nowhere, you know, the Kaiser, you know, ate a bad turkey sandwich and decided to invade. And then people pulled the wrong levers in the voting booth. Hitler got in, and he was such a powerful demagogue that he was able to rouse people up to, you know, the suicidal civil war slaughter of the European continent. And so the foreigners were one source of the problem. But this is why, you know, we had to be harsh and we had to be tough and we had to have an army and a navy and an air force and we had to be disciplined and we had to do push-ups and we had to excel in sports and we had to learn engineering and all of that, because there were these dastardly foreigners who just wanted to end our way of life. You may remember this from the recent greatest hits of the war on terror. Now, the other group that was hugely problematic when I was growing up and really was the fundamental reason for the harshness of authority were children. Oh my. Children, you see, did not fit in very well to the hierarchy that was there. So, of course, there was original sin, echoes of that. I mean, I wasn't raised Catholic, but there were certainly echoes of that, that the children were selfish. They liked candy more than Jesus. And this, of course, had to be corrected to however harshly. Children didn't listen. They weren't obedient. They didn't form lines when ordered to. They didn't want to spend all their time on homework. Sometimes they didn't run hard enough up the hill for the 30th time during physical education classes. And children were just basically bad. You know, they were like, I don't know how to put it exactly, but they were like a sack of wheat that kept breaking at the seams and had to be stitched up regularly. And the selfishness and the laziness and the untrustworthiness and the deceptive nature of children who will try and fool you at any time into thinking that they've done something that they haven't, and all that kind of stuff, the sort of lying, perfidious, underhanded, lazy nature of children was largely responsible for the harshness of the discipline that was around and above me when I was a kid, right? So, I mean, I got caned for going over a fence to go and get a soccer ball or a football that had been kicked over. And, you know, the reason that I was caned was because I knew perfectly well what the rules were. I just didn't listen. I thought I could just take it all on myself and not listen to anyone. And so it was entirely the fault of foreigners and children that discipline had to be so harsh and the world was the way it was. And if only foreigners would shape up and children would stop being selfish, I'm sure everyone could, you know, imagine living in a kind of nirvana. But I think that was the general impression that I got as a kid, that I was a badly defective adult that needed to be constantly patched up with violence in order to achieve the lofty summit of responsible adulthood.
Yeah, we recently did a show about the film that actually came out, you know, in the UK in 1971 called A Clockwork Orange, and we called the show A War on A Clockwork Orange. And the film itself, by the way, I've kind of followed your lead, and I'm getting real into film analysis these days. I think I might make a thing out of that on this show. But yeah, we were looking at the film, and not just so much the meaning of the film and the message of the film, but how the film became a lightning rod in British society for all of these problems that were already going on. You know, you have that post-war shell-shocked or post-traumatic stress disorder generation becoming adults. There, and I think that was a line that I used in the show, was it, when there's no foreigners around, you blame the kids. And it's really unfortunate that, you know, Clockwork Orange became just a symbol of youth and all that was wrong, when in reality, what's first the author Burgess and later the filmmaker Kubrick were trying to do were, you know, reflect problems that are already existed. But, you know, this is moving us right into the topic nicely. I talked to you maybe 6 months ago about this this idea for a show that I had to reach out to maybe some new people who are coming to these ideas. And, you know, maybe as so many do, they first experienced libertarianism, for lack of a better description, through politics. Here we are 6 months later after another season of political hopefulness, and reality has set in on the whole Ron Paul, Rand Paul, Gary Johnson thing, failed ballot initiatives. And there's also those people, too, who feel like maybe they've been spinning their wheels for a while and there hasn't been any meaningful progress. When people first understand these ideas and they first embrace these ideas, I think anger is a natural emotion, whether they're reflecting on their own childhood or they're taking these ideas and, you know, looking at society through the lens of the philosophy of liberty through voluntarism. You have a very active board at your site, freedomainradio.com. Have you fielded a lot of questions or a lot of dismay from new people on these types of issues?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think there's no doubt that, you know, Free Domain Radio and other shows like it, well, I don't think there are that many other shows like it, but let's just say Free Domain Radio, just to speak for my own footprint on the web, definitely it looks like there's a, you know, the airplane carrying all of the political libertarians crash landed somewhere off the coast of the island of philosophy. And, you know, a fair number of detritus, debris and people are washing up on the shore saying, you know, well, I put everything I had into this political stuff. And now I need to figure out another approach to bring liberty about. And there is, of course, a lot of frustration. The numbers have barely shifted. In fact, they've shifted in some ways downwards over the past 40 years. Right? And the first libertarian candidate polled at about 1%, and Harry Brown Powell polled at about 1%, 1% and a bit. And I think Gary Johnson got about, what was it? Oh, yes, 1%. Because, you know, people, they understand, like, it's it's not really changing. And the reason it's not changing is pretty clear. So it's, people say, well, look, I converted three people to libertarianism over the last couple of months. And that's great. I mean, that's you know, three or four more than there were before. But it's kind of like the job situation, right? They say, oh, the economy created 50,000 jobs last year. Yes, but you need 150,000 jobs a month just to keep pace with new people coming into the workforce. We are converting people, but you know, every single year, tens of millions of children come out of government schools full on status. I mean, we simply cannot keep up with the propaganda machine of the public school.
But what does that mean
to what's going on in the churches?
What does that mean to convert people? Like I more specifically, they say, yes, I'm into this. But I think the place where most of them go, and maybe the reason, I mean, I've wondered this myself, is that when people first understand these ideas and then they look at how society actually functions and they look back at their own experiences as a child, as a student, the anger, the betrayal, maybe for some, you know, as we've seen, there's people who are making a lot of money on the internet off other people's paranoia. It seems like there is this gravitation to politics. And I've wondered if people go there because, you know, anger, betrayal, paranoia, fear, politics seems like such an appropriate outlet for those kinds of emotions. It seems like that's the purpose of it, almost.
Yeah, I think you're talking about the doom porn that seems to pervade a lot of the libertarian websites. And I mean, I certainly understand that. I'm probably a little less charitable about this. Like, so I did a debate a little while back with a liberal named Sam Cedar.
Yes.
And I got a lot of complaints from people about that debate where people were saying, oh, you should have, you know, pinned him to the mat and really exposed him for what he was or whatever it is. And for me, I'm like, I just want to get through to the peaceful parenting stuff. I want to lay out a foundation for why we can have a peaceful future. And then I want people to take the bait called, how do we get there? And then I'm going to bring out the peaceful parenting. And I have a question for you. This is a question, it is directly related to the political thing. So,
sure.
Who is more committed to the non-aggression principle? A libertarian who spanks his children or a liberal who does not spank his children?
I would say the person who does not spank their children.
Right. Because
this is that's all
something you can actually affect, right?
Yeah, sorry, the rest of it is just like proxy. It's easy, like when you're putting distance between you know, yourself or your ideology and the actual acts of aggression down the line. Like, I've talked to liberals, I've talked to conservatives, and I say, let's play this game. I don't do this anymore because it turned out to be just amazingly unproductive. But I would say, let's play this game called skip to the gun, where we just skip all the steps of, you know, all the platitudes, and you get me right to the part where somebody's pointing a gun at me if I don't do exactly what you want. These are people who might even be happy. Like, out in Keene, New Hampshire, there's a lot of fanfare when, say, Ian Freeman, someone like the host of Free Talk Live, gets thrown in jail for some victimless offense. But those people who are cheering for his incarceration in the comments on some, you know, newspaper's website, they're not people who would actually enact physical force against him. So I think that the latter in your either or choice is the much more peaceful of the two options.
Yeah, I mean, I have for years been trying to stimulate a debate in the libertarian community about spanking children, aggression towards children, and it gets virtually no traction. I mean, there've definitely been some people who've changed their minds, and certainly, I mean, I've estimated tens of thousands of families as a result of my show have, and the audience participation in my show have abandoned aggression against their children, which is an incredible footprint to leave in the world. I mean, it's like, you know, dropping roses all over the desert and having them grow. So to me, that's a wonderful thing. But I actually have more in common with a liberal who is peaceful with his children than I do with a libertarian who is spanking or yelling at his kids, because that is actually going to change, right? That the liberal who's not spanking his children is doing much more to bring about a peaceful, voluntary society than someone who rails against the Fed and spanks his kids, or justifies it, or defends it, or refuses to talk about it as a topic worthy of our attention. But you and I are not likely to go out and, you know, strangle hobos and hold up nuns or whatever it is. But the choice we're going to make about aggression and violence in our lives is almost entirely to do with child raising. I mean, I'm never going to get jumped by nine ninjas and going to have to throw them off with my, you know, cat-like laser brain martial arts moves, that's never going to happen. If the police come to arrest me, I'm going to go quietly with them because I kind of want to keep body and soul together. The only fundamental choice that I'm going to have to make in my life when it comes to the aggression, the non-aggression principle, is with regards to my children. And those people who make choices with regards to their children that conform to the non-aggression principle are the true anarchists. They are the true libertarians. I don't care what they say about the Fed. I don't care what they say about Social Security, because that's just words. And who gives a crap about words? What really matters is actions. You know, by their deeds shall ye know them. And so leftists and liberals and communists and what anarchists and Jacques Fresco folks and all of these people, hey, if you are peaceful with your children, then we are brothers and sisters. And I don't care what your ideology is, because that's actually the foundation for a free society. If you are aggressive towards your children, I don't care what your opinions are about the free market, because you simply do not get the non-aggression principle. You do not understand it. You do not grok it in any kind of fundamental Heinleinian sense. So the goal of politics and reason people are drawn to politics is it's not socially volatile fundamentally, right? The idea for politics is the idea that someone is going to come in and do all the crap that I don't want to do. Someone's going to come in and save me and reduce aggression and fix the Constitution and repeal the minimum wage, privatize money. I don't know what it is that people want. It's someone's going to come in on a white horse, and I'm not going to have to do the difficult work of confronting my own history, of making a vital and fundamental, a visceral commitment to the non-aggression principle in my own life and deal with all the fallout that happens when you decide not to act aggressively towards your children. So it's a way of managing your own anxiety about the changes that you need to make in your life. I don't mean you, but one needs to make in one's life. It doesn't have anything to do with actually trying to free the world. It's entirely a defense mechanism, because empirically, we've been trying for hundreds, if not thousands of years, to use philosophy and argument and empiricism and reason to free the world. And it really hasn't worked. The one thing that has demonstrably worked is improving the peace and reason and negotiation skills of children. That empirically, scientifically, validly, historically, just look at psychohistory.com, that works in reducing violence. That is the only thing that empirically and repeatedly works in reducing violence and increasing peace and reason among mankind. If we look at it empirically and objectively, it's all about peace with children. Everything else is just distraction from that essential fact.
Yeah, I know you had Nathaniel Brandon on your show a couple years ago now, probably, and he has this book. In fact, Wes Bertrand was doing a series about it on Complete Liberty. We talked about it a little bit on my show, and the name of the book is Breaking Free. And, you know, when you describe these libertarians who wind up, you know, people who profess the philosophy of liberty and wind up, you know, striking their own children, he has this concept in the book, Brandon does, he calls it the inheritance. And I could just look at my own life and my own parenting, and, you know, I see where my parents came from, and my father especially, I think, wanted to do a better job than with his children than his mother did with him. I think that's normal. I think that's certainly something that a lot of parents, maybe not, you know, people who aren't the best parents or even putting 100% effort into parenting, they say, gosh, I want to do better than my parents. And, you know, his upbringing was awful. But if you don't deal with the impact that that had on you, the inheritance is going to continue, basically. You're going to pass that on to your next generation. Despite your desire to want to be a better parent, if you don't look at how that affected you, I think that's maybe one of the reasons that we see that kind of parenting, you know, the libertarian who spanks their child, because they've never done the personal freedom stuff. Kind of goes back to the politics thing too, is, you know, my first instinct when I learned about these ideas was to run to the thing that was furthest away from me, the Federal Reserve, elect Ron Paul.
Yeah, yeah.
The furthest thing away from things that I could actually control. And that was the idea with this red pill blues, is that, yeah, you take the red pill and you go and do all those things, and you feel very small, and you feel very defeated, and you don't feel efficacious. And, you know, I think, unfortunately, a lot of people give up, and they don't start at, you know, in the realm or the sphere, however you want to picture it, of things they actually could change and control in their lives. I certainly know that I didn't even look there for a long time.
Yeah, No, and I think that is very tempting because it is a lot safer than having to look at where can I promote the non-aggression principle in my own life. You know, I know what you mean about parents, right? So there is all the way from, you know, all parents do the very best they can with the knowledge that they have, you know, all the way to some radical feminist thing that, you know, all parents are patriarchal bastards who want to eviscerate their children with some sort of boar-tooth fangs of masculinity or something. But when I think about violence against children, I think about it often in terms of domestic abuse, right? So I don't know. I mean, this may be a little bit before your time, but sort of when I was growing up in the 70s, there was a really strong push towards awareness of domestic abuse. And domestic abuse basically meant husbands hitting wives, husbands beating wives, husbands mistreating wives. And it was really powerful propaganda. And I don't mean that necessarily in a bad way. I mean, it was a 30-second clip. You'd see them on TV. You know, spousal abuse is unacceptable. You know, one hit and you walk. Any form of violence is unacceptable in human relationships. Like, you know, don't stand for it. And as a result, you know, the divorce rates went through the roof. I was talking to a friend of mine recently. She came back from Chile, and Chile has recently allowed no-fault divorce. The divorce rate is 80%. 80%, because you don't actually have to prove that you're being mistreated. You can just say, I walk from this marriage, and the whole family is falling apart there. And I don't remember, like when I was a kid growing up, and this happened all the way through my teens and into my 20s, I don't remember a single instance of anyone saying, well, husbands who beat their wives are doing the best they can with the knowledge that they have. You know, they have really great intentions. Maybe they're just lacking particular skills. Like, I don't remember any of that. What I do remember was, you know, they were really portrayed as bad guys, beating up their wives, yelling at their wives, abusing their wives, cutting off money from their wives, abandoning their wives, having affairs on their wives, ignoring their wives, whatever it is, the sort of male chauvinist pig thing. I don't remember any sympathy for the abuser. Now, I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm just saying that that's what I recall as a kid. And that is how I look at, to some degree, how I look at sort of the parent adult child. When you're a child, you sort of struggle through as best you can. But the parent adult child, I'm not sure why the standards suddenly shift, you know, where we're not allowed to have any sympathy at all for a man who hits his wife even once. But parents who repeatedly hit their children, whether it's spanking or something even more serious, we have to start making up all these excuses for them. And I can't fathom that. I mean, other than maybe it's just a hangover of honor their mother and their father, you know, the one commandment that we seem to be having a great deal of trouble examining rationally. But that's sort of where I come from. Like, I read on psychology websites, they say, you know, if he hits once, he's going to hit again. If he hits you for the first time, leave and never look back. But then when it comes to an abusive parent, the story completely changes. And it's like, well, you know, they're struggling. They're doing the best they can. They themselves had bad childhoods. Like, I don't ever remember when I was a kid, if a husband beat his wife, I don't ever remember people saying, well, you see, but he had a difficult, the husband had a difficult childhood. So she's really got to stand that he's struggling with that. And maybe he didn't prepare as much as he could for marriage, but he's doing the best he can. There was none of that. There was just a clear line drawn in the sand. And I think which had significant effects. I mean, abuse against women declined by a third after no-fault divorce went in. It seems that promoting voluntarism within marriage has done a great deal to reduce spousal abuse. I also believe that promoting voluntarism in the parent-adult-child relationship is also going to do its part to reduce violence against children. So anyway, that's sort of where I'm coming from. And so I have a little bit less tolerance for, maybe a lot less tolerance for their doing the best they can argument, because I certainly never saw that when I was growing up for a far less egregious abuser than a parental abuser.
No, I my perspective is a little bit different, and I'm sure that's a question that you fielded countless number of times. My parents were really great. They did the best they can. You know, I know when I was growing up, this is something that I've discussed on the show before. You know, my mother, you know, I would describe her today as sort of very weak-willed. She was very either emotionally distant or reactionary, like she would, you know, flip out about something. And there was very little in between. And this was a very difficult thing to, you know, experience as a young child. Well, you know, as I grew up, and I obviously got out of that situation when I was 18 and went on to do other things, During that time, my mother got divorced. She went into therapy, you know, and I would say today, as I know her today, it's one of the most significant transformations that I've seen in a human being that I've
actually known
in my life. So that's a little bit of a different perspective. But also the other thing, too, about, you know, I know that using a phrase like empathizing with an abuser is very, very explosive. And I would attach maybe a bit of a selfish motive to it. When we look at, let's just take the parent-child relationship, and we look at things that might have happened to us when we were kids, I think that probably the most serious and in-depth evaluation of anyone's parenting is going to be done by that person's child probably later in life. You know, maybe the neighbors have something to say, maybe grandma has something to say once in a while, but the most in-depth, meaningful evaluation of what somebody did as a parent is probably going to be done by, you know, a pretty self-aware child later in life when they're trying to understand how that affected them. Now, of course, anger is certainly, I think, very healthy emotion. I've been plenty angry about, you know, a lot of things that happened to me related to family and otherwise. But, you know, I realized at one point when I felt like I was holding a lot of different resentments towards a lot of different people in a lot of different areas of my life, that I was never going to have that, you know, Emperor Palpatine Return of the Jedi power to transfer any of that electrically into somebody else's body. That I was just renting out space to, you know, all of those people through those resentments in my own head. And that was one of the things that I wanted to ask you about. Yes, anger is healthy. Yes, resentment is, you know, a normal product of that anger. But how do people process that, acknowledge that, and let it go?
Right, right. Okay. Yeah. So there's people who've, and I'm just going to talk about abuse victims here. I'm not, of course, putting you in that category, Brett, but I'm just talking about my amateur opinions Sure. about abuse victims. So people who have been victimized, the scientific studies seem to be quite clear that the best chance you have for not reinflicting that abuse is to get angry about it. Because when you get angry about it, you engage your sort of moral immune system to recognize it as a great wrong that was done to you, and to get angry about the way that you were treated, and not to try and over-empathize with your abuser. I mean, that's really, I think, quite a dangerous thing to do. And we're not asked to do that in any other sphere. Like, to take an extreme example, a woman who gets raped is not asked to empathize with the rapist. A man who gets assaulted is not asked to empathize with his assaulter, and so on. But so I think that's, and this comes out of an article by Robin Grill, which I read recently, the psychologist from Australia, that the science is very clear. The best way to stop the cycle of abuse is to get angry at having been abused. And this is why I'm very critical of people who make up excuses for abusers, because it's not because I hate the abusers. It's because I really don't want this to be reinflicted. And the best way to have it not being reinflicted on your own kids is to get angry at how you treat it.
Yeah, Robin Grill.
Been victimized. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, Robin Grill, who you've interviewed, right?
Yeah.
I like Robin Grill, and I've been reading through some of his work, and it was in your interview or another where I heard him use the phrase denormalizing that parental treatment, yeah. Because it's all we have. It's all we know. We have nothing to, you can't say, you know, my parents compared to what? You might get glimpses of other people's relationship with their mom or their dad, but that's normal parental treatment. And a lot of opportunity exists in anger. So I think that's what he was driving at, right? That getting in touch with that is a way to heal.
But the problem is, of course, if you've been the victim of child abuse, I mean, child abusers don't harm you when they're calm. They don't harm you when they're happy. They harm you when they're enraged. And so the great danger, of course, is that we then create this connection, which is that because I was abused when my parents got angry, anger is abusive.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a very dangerous supposition to have. It's perfectly understandable that we would have that. But that which you most need to protect yourself and your future children from abuse is anger. So if you say, well, my parents always abused me when they were angry, therefore anger is abusive, therefore I can't get angry, therefore the opposite of abuse is to make up excuses and pretend to forgive my parents, that's how it reproduces. This is the great danger. If you don't get angry at it, it's most likely to reproduce psychologically and scientifically. And so this is the great danger, right? So my parents abused me when they were angry. therefore anger is abusive, therefore I'm going to get all Buddhist on them and say, well, they did the best they could and I'm not going to get angry. But this is the problem. This is how it's most likely to reproduce, right? So this is the great danger. So finding a way to get angry without that anger being abusive and destructive is a challenge. And I think that something needs to be worked out and with a very good therapist and with journaling and with all of that. But learning how to become angry without being abusive saves you from being abusive, at least the most likely thing to save you from being abusive. It gives you a great deal of security and safety in the world, because anger is the body's defense system against exploitation, emotional exploitation, financial exploitation, hierarchy exploitation, business exploitation, love, sex exploitation, whatever. Anger is our natural defense. We wouldn't want to not have an immune system. That's called having AIDS or living in a bubble in a Seinfeld episode or something. We don't want to have that. We want to have the natural reaction to dangerous and invasive viruses. And human exploitation is a dangerous and invasive virus. It can strip away years of your life and half your savings or all of them if you get conned and exploited. So the essential thing is to decouple abuse from anger and to learn how to get angry in a way that is actually protective of yourself without necessarily being abusive towards others, and certainly not abusive towards the innocent. And that's not easy. It takes a lot of self-knowledge. It takes a lot of work. It takes, I think, working with a therapist to learn that. But it is not the case that if you get angry at having been abused, that you then suddenly fall into anger forever, you become destructive and abusive and so on. Quite the opposite is true. If you can, you know, as Aristotle said, it's the mean, right? So a deficiency of courage, right, he called cowardice, and an excess of courage he called foolhardiness, right, where you just go charging over the World War One trench with, you know, a pea shooter and a thong, and, you know, you're not going to do much except get riddled with Swiss cheese. And so learning how to get the right level of anger, and Aristotle said, he said, look, getting angry is easy. Anyone can get angry. You know, poke a baboon with a stick, he's going to get angry. And anyone can not get angry, can pretend to take the high road, can swallow their upset and not get angry. Neither of those are morally good or the right thing to do. It is difficult to get angry in the right way, at the right time, you know, for the right effect, under the right circumstances, in a just way. But it is a skill that we really essentially do need to learn, because without the capacity to get justly angry, we are open to significant amounts of exploitation, and therefore we will end up exploiting others, because it tends to be a kind of pass-through equation.
Yeah, in parenting, and I think this is, we'll take a break here in a couple minutes before we go on to our next topic, but it's okay to let your children know that you have, that what they do affects you in an emotional way, right? So I think that would be someplace that would be incredibly dangerous if you hadn't mastered, or maybe not even mastered, but become aware of how anger can turn into abuse. And we're not just talking about physical abuse, you know, verbal abuse, disconnecting, that threat of the withdrawal of affection, parental affection from children are all consequences of, you know, yes, I get angry. I shouldn't get angry. I'm going to try to handle it or mishandle it like this.
I just wanted to mention one other thing, which is that in my experience, anger can be extremely intimate. That sounds very counterintuitive to a lot of people. But rage, which is, you know, a sort of an immature and explosive way of avoiding whatever prior traumas and hurts have discombobulated you, or in a sense, defending the actions of abusers by reenacting them and normalizing them, by being inhabited by the sort of biting ghosts that fed on your childhood. That, of course, is destructive. But when people in my life, if they get angry at me or I get angry at them, we have an honest conversation, it really does draw us closer. Because anger basically is saying, I really care about something that you did. You know, it is not the opposite of love. It is a component of love, because we don't all act perfectly. And in our imperfections lies knowledge, self-knowledge, and the growth of intimacy. So anger in intimate relationships, being angry about something that someone else did, having them be angry at you, having an honest discussion about that, you know, without attack, without insults, without escalations and extrapolations, you always, you never, but simply being honest about the feeling of anger can be an intensely intimate and growing experience. And of course, if you are in a love relationship or even a friendship, which is the kind of love relationship, if you can both get angry and talk it through, what an amount of trust there is in that relationship. I mean, so many relationships fail and falter because anger is either acted out in an immature, raging way, which is really the avoidance of the true issues, and a significant lack of preparation for an intimate relationship. Or people suppress their anger, and therefore they're not close to each other because now they're essentially lying to each other. You know, that old cliche, you go home and your girlfriend is storming around and your wife is storming around, and you say, "What's the matter, honey?" "Nothing." Bang, right? But this is lying. This is falsehood. This drives people apart. If you can get angry with people, or they can get angry with you in a way that is honest, that is true, that is not abusive, it is an incredibly binding experience, and not codependently, but a very intimate experience. And this is something that people who haven't worked with their anger, I think, don't really get, that anger is part of being in an intimate relationship. We're all going to do things that annoy each other, but being able to talk through that anger is an incredible cementing and trust growth in the relationship.
So let me ask you this, and I know this is a lot of the stuff that you cover in Real Time Relationships, your book. When you are expressing anger to another person, how I'm interested in how it's framed, because one thing that I've noticed is that so often, and I know I've done this plenty in the past, I've framed descriptions of how I actually feel in terms of what somebody else is doing to me. So instead of saying, you know, I have a need for autonomy, or I might say I'm feeling coerced, right? This is something that's being done to me.
It's not a feeling.
I'm feeling coerced. I'm feeling judged. I'm feeling manipulated. I'm feeling threatened. I mean, what the common denominator is those are all verbs that people do to you. And it's not about what you're truly feeling. So it's not exactly the same thing, but it's not too dissimilar to what we were talking about before as going to the furthest thing away from you politically and trying to control that and just feeling powerless. If anger is directed towards what somebody, or if that emotional energy or awareness is directed towards what somebody else is doing, I think it kind of can get you into that same non-efficacious feeling trap. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, for me, the feeling, it's got to pass the elbow test. And the elbow test, like, say you get a pain in your elbow, right? And you go to the doctor, and the doctor says, "Where does it hurt?" He says, "Elbow." And he says, "Well, what does it feel like?" You don't say, "Well, I feel that my elbow is being exploited, and I feel that my elbow is seeking more autonomy, and I feel that my elbow is being coerced." The doctor would say, "I have no idea what any of that means." Well, it's kind of a throb, or it's a dull ache, or it's a sharp pain, or it's an intermittent discomfort, or, you know, it's just a kind of tension, or whatever it is, right? Those are things that can actually... So think of it like a physical pain. So if I'm angry at someone, if I'm angry at a friend, then there's two possibilities. Either I know exactly what happened, and therefore I can go and explain everything and so on, or, since that never happens, I never know exactly what happened, I can go and say to my friend, "Listen, Bob, when this happened, when you said this, when I did that, I felt this physical surge of tension and anger. And I don't know why. I don't know why." Because generally that's the truth. In relationships, it's complex. It's really complex. To rush in with a conclusion doesn't open a dialogue, right? The moment you have a conclusion in an interaction, you are no longer having a dialogue. And to have a dialogue about anger, we have to be vulnerable enough to say, "I'm angry and I don't know why." Because I guarantee you, that's always going to be an honest statement. "I do not know why I'm angry." I mean, it's a little different if someone drives over your foot. Then that's not what I'm talking about in sort of intimate relationship. You want to open up a dialogue about anger, and we tend to try and control the interaction by coming in with a conclusion, right? So, as you know, in real-time relationships, I'm very much against coming into a complex, intimate interaction with conclusions. "Well, you know, I'm angry because you said this, and that was insulting to me, and therefore you did the wrong thing, and it's all because of your relationship with your aunt spider, and that's exactly what it is." Well, you can't go anywhere with that because you've just come in with all these conclusions. Central planning is a conclusion, right? This is why communism doesn't work. It's the free market is a dialogue. It's a negotiation about prices and needs and wants and preferences and services and goods and all this kind of stuff. Central planning is, you know, we need 500 tons of timber delivered to Minsk tomorrow morning. There's no negotiation, right? So you understand that to come into a relationship discussion with conclusions is to be a Soviet central planner. And it's really the opposite of a free market dialogue that's needed. So you go in, you say, "I'm angry. I don't know why. It happened when you said this, but I don't know exactly why. What were you feeling? And then you can actually have a dialogue about it where you're really mutually exploring what happened for you in the interaction without coming to the inevitable self-righteous judgment conclusions called, you did X, you're a bad person, you made me angry. These things are generally not true. They're dishonest. And as a result, because they're both conclusions and therefore necessarily dishonest, they close off opportunities for exploration. And intimacy is curiosity and exploration.
Okay, yeah, so I think we're both examples are similar in that it's jumping the gun, right? So whether you're jumping the gun in a way where you are passing a judgment on what the other person is doing, you're doing blank to me, or jumping the gun on the analysis of what we're actually feeling when in the moment you might not know. All right, that makes sense. Do you want to take a 2-minute break and then I'll bring in my co-host and we can do a little parenting talk before we let you go, Steph?
Yeah, that sounds great.
All right. This is School Sucks Live. We'll be back real quick. Steph, feel free to freestyle if you want. Freestyle rap.
Talking about anger, nothing like banger. This is what we want when we're having intimacy. I'll stop now.
Hi, this is Brett. And in case you haven't heard, I would like you to pay me $6 a month for doing School Sucks Podcast. Now, I know some of you are saying, Brett, no. But others might be asking, $6 a month, what are you going to do to earn it? Well, let me start by telling you this. In 2012, the number of monthly subscribers grew by almost 100%. And as a result of that growth, I had the time and resources necessary to produce more shows, release more videos, grow our YouTube subscribers by over 100%. I increased podcast listeners by almost 40% and debuted a live call-in show on Ustream and LRN.fm. But now, with the new website at schoolsucksproject.com, all subscribers get access to a bonus content section called the AV Club. Now, some of you might be saying, Brett, that's probably just you and your friends effing around. But that couldn't be further from the truth. How about a little peek at what's inside? Drop the beat. Everybody knows. Role play.
I asked you a question.
Yeah, but why? Who are you? I don't understand what's happening.
Do you see this badge on my chest?
So you are airport security?
Sir, I work for the transportation security asshole.
That's not what it stands for.
Men's health issues.
If my brain wasn't evolved enough to handle as much porn as I watch, how would I be able to watch that much porn and not have exploded by now?
Well, very rarely will you see a man explode.
Experimental radio.
I'm Gardner Goldsmith along with Brett.
That's never been done before.
Oh, political science.
All a dog will ever make is poop, and all bureaucrats ever make when they're at work is government.
Regular science.
I have a disease that makes me turn into a bat.
Science fiction.
Now, I love Doctor Who, but his explanations are so cockamamie.
History.
Abraham Lincoln spent a lot of time around logs.
I learned that in school.
Yeah, he also had a giant blue ox named Babe.
And he freed the slaves.
Foreign affairs.
The Russians. Remember them?
Yeah.
Huh. They'll be back.
Friendships.
Okay, we are back.
Yeah! Fuck you.
Interviews.
What do you like to do? What are you calling for?
I like to giggle.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Me too.
Philosophers interviewing dead terrorists in heaven.
I have a question for Osama. So, according to certain interpretations of Islamic law, you get 72 virgins in heaven. What I don't understand is that in heaven, I don't think anybody ages. Like, you don't get older because you're never going to die. So nothing about your body changes. So isn't it the case that these women are going to stay virgins for the rest of time?
Osama hates that. Osama has 72 virgins, and they just keep telling me that they love me. They always text me, I love you, Osama, and put a little smiley face at the end.
That's good to know. It's good to get that kind of feedback on what's going on in heaven there.
Presidential wisdom.
Three words. Transdimensional lizard Jews.
Snakes. On a plane.
Snakes on a plane! Snakes on a plane! Aw, shit! Snakes on a plane!
You guys are great!
Liberals.
I really suggest you check out a book. It's written by Professor Richard Crabtree. It's called How I Know Everything About Why the Free Market Doesn't Work, Even Though I Never Spent 5 Minutes of My Career Outside of Academia. Volume 1.
and of course, the behind-the-scenes planning of some of our greatest moments.
I'm going to make him get up and face somebody and pretend like he's showing them his and then that later that person gives him a job and they get married. It should be Kokesh.
This is going to be an absolute train wreck, dude.
So don't settle for some corny four-minute ad that takes reputable people out of context in a comically misleading way, like this.
Do we want a giant mommy state or do we want a giant daddy state? Because what else is there?
Right.
And this.
They demolish the buildings with lasers from the sky.
And this.
And we're going to make sure all businesses supply hardcore porn. You know what I mean?
No, instead, get in there. There's over 150 hours of additional content. And even if you don't have time to listen to it all, which nobody does, once in a while it's okay to go on a little internet treasure hunt. So go to schoolsucksproject.com and click on the support tab.
I'm Newt Gingrich, and I endorse this message.
Thank you for your participation.